A resurgence in methamphetamines. For the first time in a long time, the number of deaths in Maine from opioids is down slightly from the year before. But at the same time, emergency responders and hospitals are seeing an uptick in deaths related to meth. In Maine, the number of meth overdose deaths rose 21% from 2017 to 2018, and police are finding more illegal meth in drug busts. Some of the meth is homegrown from illicit labs in Maine communities, but experts say a lot is coming from drug cartels in Mexico. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Why is there a resurgence in methamphetamines? Why is it so dangerous, and what's being done to stop it? Do you know someone who is using crystal meth? Today's show is part of Maine Calling's ongoing focus on substance use in our state. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. News about opioid use in Maine has dominated headlines in recent years, but during that time, another drug has resurged, methamphetamine. We'll learn why this highly addictive drug is on the rise and what can be done about it. Joining me in the studio, Leslie Clark, who is Executive Director of Portland Recovery Community Center. Dr. Jonathan Fellers is an addiction psychiatrist with private practice. He's also medical director at Crossroads and at Discovery House. And Roy McKinney is director of Maine's Drug Enforcement Agency. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you know of anyone who is using meth or in recovery for it? Are you concerned about it coming into your community? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Dr. Fellers, many people know methamphetamine as meth, crystal meth, or speed. Tell us what distinguishes this drug from other addictive drugs.
So methamphetamine is a stimulant, very much like cocaine and other stimulants, some that we actually prescribe for ADHD. You may be familiar with them, like Adderall and Ritalin. But what's unique about methamphetamine is that it's very potent. It's also quite cheap relative to a lot of the other drugs that people misuse out there. And the consequences of its use are quite accelerated relative to other drugs, meaning people develop quite serious problems quickly, and it has a lot of psychiatric problems that result. So people can become quite psychotic with its use. It's really something that, as an addiction psychiatrist, I'm really interested in because it has both the addiction quality, but it also really impacts people's mental health much more than some other substances out there. And that's the specialty that I've chosen. And so it's a topic that's at least an area I'm really interested in.
All right. Well, Roy, we've been hearing reports of meth on the rise in Maine. What have you been seeing statewide? What are officers telling you? What kind of arrests are you seeing?
What we're seeing is the rise of, or more availability of, crystal methamphetamine. Maine has had an issue with methamphetamine, very small production laboratories, if you will, dating back to 2011. I believe we had 7. 2016, that number rose to 126. As law enforcement became better aware of these labs, but since 16, we've seen those numbers decline. Last year, they were down to 51. Thus far in this year, we've seen 28. But with that decline, we are hearing more from local law enforcement, as well as the work by the men and women of Maine Drug Enforcement with the seizure of crystal methamphetamine in amounts that are much higher than we've ever seen before. And as an example, in 2017, we saw less than 200 grams of crystal methamphetamine seized just by Maine Drug Enforcement efforts. And last year, that rose to just over 5 pounds. So it gives a sense of that number, and it's also reflected in its mentions in drug-related deaths.
So when you're talking about meth that's made in a lab versus crystal meth, are you talking about something that's two different substances?
No, excellent question. No, it's the same substance, but with crystal methamphetamine, it's a more refined, highly pure form of methamphetamine, as opposed to in these one pod or shake and bake, as most folks have heard about, probably about an ounce at a time can be made, whereas with these super labs, it's multi-kilos are produced at one time that is refined, and the purity levels are approaching 98%.
And I'm guessing that means they're much more dangerous. Is that true, Jonathan?
Right. The higher the potency of it. Although the crude one-pot batches can also be incredibly dangerous, not because of the potency of the methamphetamine, but because of all the adulterants and the incomplete purification. So there can be byproducts of that manufacture that are also quite dangerous too, but different dangers, I guess, of the two compounds.
Leslie, I want to bring you into the conversation. At your recovery center, have you noticed a shift towards more methamphetamine use recently?
We have. Over this past year, we've seen a lot more people coming in seeking help because of crystal meth in particular. And at the PRCC, we partner with the Scarborough Police Department for Operation Hope. And I think the last several people who have come in seeking treatment, where typically that program was for people with opioid addiction that were looking for treatment, the last several have been seeking help for crystal meth.
How does helping these people in recovery differ? We've heard so much about the opioid epidemic. How is how you help them different from how you help somebody who's coming in with a methamphetamine addiction?
That's a really good question. I think actually there's probably more that is similar than is different. I think what we see that is different is people, especially if they're still active, they can be very violent. They can be psychotic, really out of touch with reality and hard to even sort out what's going on for them. But the recovery itself is all about connecting with other people who've been in their shoes. It's about a lot of things, but at the Portland Recovery Community Center, what we provide are support groups, recovery coaching, meeting with peers, and helping someone find their journey to wellness and to health, which could be treatment, it could be outpatient, inpatient, it could involve a lot of different things, but primarily meeting them, letting them know that there is hope, and helping them get connected to the services that they need.
Dr. Fellers, what would you like to add to that?
Well, you know, the opioid epidemic in one way is we're kind of fortunate that we have a lot of excellent treatments for it, meaning like there is a lot of medication-assisted treatment or MAT available. So that includes methadone as well as Suboxone or buprenorphine and Vivitrol. For methamphetamine, we really don't have any medications to help. And so as a provider, it really leaves us with not many tools in our arsenal of what we can do. And so the mainstay of treatment is really more intensive psychosocial treatments, so things like residential treatment and intensive outpatient treatment. And there is a specific a form of IOP called the Matrix Model that SAMHSA has developed and that we actually do use at Crossroads, but it's really psychosocial. We don't have any medications to help. We do have medications to help with some of the consequences. So what I mean by that is if someone becomes psychotic on it, it's really quite indistinguishable from schizophrenia after a period of time. And so managing the co-occurring conditions is really important. But we don't have any magic bullet or anything to help with the craving or to reduce the risk of relapse. And it leaves us with limited tools.
So you're treating someone with a long-term addiction to methamphetamine the same way you're treating someone with schizophrenia?
Well, that's not a complete accurate comparison, but yes, like after a period of time, people who use methamphetamine can develop an almost permanent psychosis that is indistinguishable from schizophrenia, which is one of the major consequences of continued use over time. And they would be treated just like anyone with schizophrenia. But the initial treatment is not necessarily the same. So someone who has developed psychosis initially may not have that as a permanent consequence of the use. And that would be the ultimate solution, to stop the use so that we can prevent that progression to a more permanent psychotic state.
Roy, are there parts of Maine where we're seeing more methamphetamine than others? I noticed several arrests in Aroostook County. Is that a place where we're seeing more methamphetamine?
Aroostook County is unique in that for some time there has been a small user population there, dating back to the early 2000s. Aroostook County was the only county where we saw what's referred to as Yaba tablets or methamphetamine pressed into a tablet form. That's not the case now. We've seen labs go down across Aroostook County from where they were. At one time, they were at the pinnacle, but now we're seeing that replaced with crystal methamphetamine. But at the same time, about half the counties last year experienced at least one meth lab-related incident. Penobscot County, there were seven, and then... I believe it was, was York County with seven as well. So second most populous county with York County, we had seven incidents. And then Penobscot County, which is the most populous of the northern counties, had seven. So it's not defined by any one particular area, but typically what happens if one person knows how to make meth, they'll teach six other people, and that's how we can. That's how it spreads, if you will. But again, the data is suggesting that we've seen a decline in those numbers of incidents. And thus far this year, I expect we will see a further decline from last year's numbers with regard
in the labs, not in the use labs. And not the deaths, but the labs.
That's correct. That's correct. The Attorney General just reported in the first quarter of this year there were eight. Deaths in which methamphetamine was mentioned. Last year there was 26 in total.
And eight so far in the first quarter, yeah.
That's correct.
Joining us on the line now is John DeLina, Associate Special Agent in charge with the Drug Enforcement Administration's New England Field Division. Thanks for calling in, John.
Well, thank you for having me.
Talk to us about where this crystal meth is coming from to Maine.
Yeah, and first of all, thanks to Director McKinney because, you know, he really set the stage for what I wanted to talk about. And he has it, you know, exactly right as usual. While we were dealing with some homegrown methamphetamine problems throughout northern New England and Maine in particular, and Penobscot in York, just like he said, we now have the Mexican cartels who have decided that, you know, they can make more money by sending crystal methamphetamine into our area, and that's exactly what they've done. And they're doing it for a few different reasons. You know, obviously we know that it's fentanyl for the most part that's killing our neighbors, our brothers, our sisters, our friends. And with that, you know, comes a few different things. There's some people that are taking the medically assisted treatment, the opioid blockers, to try to get themselves off of the opioids. But sadly, some of those people are still looking to get high, and some of those people, and if you talk to people in probation and people that are giving these urinalysis exams, you know, the numbers back that up. A lot of those people are now making that switch to methamphetamine. You also have people, and I've talked to thousands of people that are battling this addiction. You have some people that if they're using fentanyl, if they're using the opioids, they simply need something to get them up off the ground almost every single day. So they start that vicious cycle of that up and down, up and down. And the Mexican cartels, they're genius. They're smarter than anything that we could ever possibly come up against. They have better research and development than any Fortune 500 company. They know that's happening. They study these trends and they look at an area like Maine in particular, and they see that rise of opioid addiction. And they say, here's the next best thing. This is what people are going to want. So they start flooding our market with it. And that's exactly what they've done. The cases that we see are indicative of that. More numbers, more poundage than we've ever seen before coming into our area. And they want it out there as samples. They want people to know it's available. Now, the scary part for us is the strength and purity far exceeds anything that somebody in a homegrown one-pot methamphetamine lab can create in New York or Penobscot. It's so much more pure. The strength is there, and a lot of people don't realize that. We also see people that are starting to mix it and put it in with fentanyl as well. I don't have the exact figures from Maine. Maybe Director McKinney does, but I know in New Hampshire, the numbers have skyrocketed. And when you look at the states, there's a lot of similarities. And I think I heard today from the state crime lab director in New Hampshire who said all of a sudden they're taking in more methamphetamine exhibits than fentanyl exhibits. That hasn't happened in years.
John, as you said that, every single one of our guests nodded when you said you're seeing more methamphetamine mixed with fentanyl, which I'm guessing is a really horrible cocktail. I understand that you have seen some of these labs in Mexico. Describe to me what you've seen.
Well, thank you for asking. Yes, I was fortunate, fortunate enough recently to take some police executives into Mexico for a trip to really help people understand, you know, sort of the big picture of what DEA is trying to accomplish, along with our U.S. government counterparts down there, working with our Mexican counterparts. And as part of that trip, DEA and the Mexican government had just seized a crystal methamphetamine lab in the jungles of Sinaloa. So they held that crime scene for us, and they actually flew us there in a military aircraft. And under the protection of hundreds of armed military and law enforcement, they brought us into this jungle. And it's exactly like you would imagine. Literally, we went off-road and ended up somewhere in the middle of a jungle, got out of our cars, crawled through a bunch of bush and brush and everything else, and came to sort of a clearing in the middle of nowhere where there was this unbelievably sophisticated laboratory with hundreds upon hundreds of 55-gallon drums, 10-gallon buckets, a generator the size of a Tahoe that was supplying power to this lab. And by the way, this one lab in the middle of the jungle was capable of producing and was producing 7 tons of crystal methamphetamine every 3 days. 7 tons every 3 days. And the further significance of that is that we know through our investigations that the area of Sinaloa and the Sinaloa cartel, for the most part, that's the drugs that we see in the Northeast. That's the drugs that we're seeing in Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Maine. So it's fair to say that there's a high probability that some of that methamphetamine was ending up on our own streets. That's just one lab capable of producing 7 tons every 3 days. Think about the enormity of that.
John, you talked about how the Sinaloa cartel and others are marketing directly to New England and how this is, you know, calculated and that they're smart. What is law enforcement doing around New England to combat it? You know, how do we not throw our hands up in frustration?
Well, listen, we'll never give up. We can throw our hands up in frustration. I thought you were going to say, how do we not give up? We never give up. What we are doing and doing better than ever before is we're working smarter and we're working together. You know, Director McKinney has some brave men and women that are out there in his department, as well as all of the agencies throughout Maine. And we're all working together. I think, you know, what we've all realized is, you know, by combining efforts, what we have to do in an effort to sort of connect all the dots on these cases is we have to collect all the dots first. So, you know, if there's a small seizure of crystal methamphetamine in York, and we can connect that maybe to a larger organization that's going down into, say, Massachusetts, and then we can take that case from Massachusetts and work it into Mexico, that's what we need to do. Because if we're simply bound by jurisdiction, if we're only worried about the four corners of our city that we happen to be patrolling, we're never going to be able to make a significant difference. We're only playing whack-a-mole at that point. So we need to continue to work together. And the thing that I'm most proud of and the thing that I see as the glowing example of what we're doing in Maine is we are working together. You know, we have just some unbelievable law enforcement officers and first responders that have come together to say, how do we get the most out of these cases? And that was really the purpose of our trip to Mexico, to say, we can seize drugs all day long. But what we need to do is we need to get indictments and we need to extradite people to face justice. And we've been doing that. We've been pulling people out of Mexico and out of the Dominican Republic to face charges in the United States. That's where we have the best bang for our buck.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. That's John DeLena. He is Associate Special Agent in Charge with the New England Field Division of DEA. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. Stay with us.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Evergreen Home Performance, a Marvin replacement contractor offering window and door replacement services. More at evergreenyourhome.com. And Beth's Farm Market of Warren, featuring a selection of seasonal and locally grown fruits, vegetables, and herbs, fresh picked daily. More at bethsfarmmarket.com.
On the next Fresh Air, we look at the bizarre world of insects and why we can't live without them. Anne Svardrup Thygesen, professor of conservation biology, tells us why fruit flies are more useful than we think and how cockroaches could be vital to our survival. Her book is called Buzz, Sting, Bite. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock.
Brexit, trade wars, a crumbling EU. Is the relationship between America and Europe in trouble?
The United States serves as a pacifier.
Journalists are at risk around the world, and the President of the United States and the President of Russia are laughing about this.
Or is this just another tense time in a long history of transatlantic collaboration? A global debate on the next Intelligence Squared U.S.
That's coming up at 2 o'clock on Wednesday afternoon right here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the rise in methamphetamine use. Joining me, Jonathan Fellers, who's an addiction psychiatrist and medical director at Crossroads and at Discovery House. Roy McKinney, director of Maine's Drug Enforcement Agency, and Leslie Clark, executive director of Portland Recovery Community Center. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Calling in now is Michael Bills, who lives in Calais and is father of a young boy. Michael was addicted for 15 years on and off and has been sober for the past 4 years. He is a recovery advocate, public speaker, and a volunteer at the Down East Recovery Support Center in Calais. Michael, thanks so much for calling in.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
You know, as I just read, you struggled with addiction for a long time. How did it start for you?
I started with pain medication from an injury in college, and then from there it just progressed. I became a poly substance abuser, and then I got really hooked when basalt and methamphetamines hit Bangor, Maine, where I lived. I just couldn't shake the speed addiction.
So you're one of the people that the special agent was just talking about, where it was opioids first, but then sought out other drugs.
Yeah. I mean, the opioids stopped working for my addictive personality, and then, you know, I started mixing and matching and trying different equations, and the only thing that I could ever keep progressing in my addiction with is the methamphetamines and the speed.
What made you decide you needed to stop?
I started getting health consequences. I started losing people. When I first started using, I didn't know anybody that had died or overdosed or lost their life to the addiction. And then, you know, as I got immersed in it, I started losing people in my circle, you know, and my final straw is an overdose that left me on life support for 3 days in at a hospital in Bangor, and that was the turning point for me. Is you know, I finally got enough fear into me to start to work as equally as hard as try to get sober.
You're in recovery, I understand, 4 years now, and now help others who are trying to recover. What do you tell them? What do you think is the key to really recovering?
Keep at it. Keep reaching out. There's somebody out there that has, you know, shared your experience. You know, keep searching for that person. You know, it's a due diligence thing. You can't be lazy in recovery. You have to go at it, you know, first thing in the morning till the minute you close your eyes. You know, it's a lifelong thing for me.
Well, Michael, congratulations to you and good luck to you. And thank you so much for calling into Maine Calling today. Leslie, go ahead.
Yes. Thank you, Michael, and for sharing that so beautifully. I think what he says is so true. And the issue of most people, and I'll speak also as a person in long-term recovery. So I work at the Recovery Community Center, but I'm also a person in long-term recovery. And I think for whatever reason, those of us who are born, our genetics, our biology, whatever it is that makes us susceptible to addiction in a way that maybe other people aren't, it's not enough usually just to take away one substance without addressing what's underneath all that. What the anxiety, you know, why do I feel restless out in the world? Why do I feel like I don't fit in? And then when the drugs go away, you have to connect with other people. You have to change everything because your world is built around the people that you hung out with, if you still have anybody to hang out with anymore and haven't burned those bridges, who are all also into drugs, alcohol, whatever the substances are. So to find a group of people, which is the, you know, beauty of a recovery community center where you can go connect with people. To put some perspective, at the Portland Recovery Community Center, we had 48,000 visits in this past year, just this past year, with over 50 different kinds of support groups and activities and ways of connecting. And with the crystal meth in particular, and Jonathan can talk more about this than I can as a physician, but what that drug does to the brain and the dopamine receptors, I think it's a particularly difficult, what I hear from others who have recovered from this, is it's a particularly difficult and longer recovery to start feeling pleasure again and not just feel numb and deadened, and to have a place to do that. And as the caller just said, and we're so happy there are these new recovery community centers all over the state now, to have a place to connect with people and have others who have walked that path and can help you is just so critical. And you know, Jonathan said there isn't really an effective A medication for this, and that's why the psychosocial is so important and the social connections with others.
Did you want to jump in, Jonathan?
Sure. So methamphetamine in particular is just really potent, and how it works is it's mimicked kind of like dopamine. And so the cells in the brain kind of pick it up just like dopamine, like any other neurotransmitter. And then what it does is it kind of empties the cells of all their dopamine that they've stored up over time. And that's kind of how it kind of releases its euphoria, and it's the effect that everybody looks for in it. The consequence of that is that people after using are completely depleted of dopamine. And methamphetamine is also neurotoxic. It can also damage those dopamine neurons and the serotonin neurons as well. And so there's a profound depletion of neurotransmitters, a prolonged state of post-acute withdrawal where people exhibit symptoms of anhedonia, which is just a fancy word of saying can't get any pleasure out of any activities at all, because nothing can be as similar as that huge flood of dopamine that we're not meant to experience that in real life. And now you're depleted of that dopamine. So nothing can be as similar to that. And people, it's really a tough situation to recover from, because you can recall that experience of how wonderful that drug was. And at the same time, you're in a state of depletion where you're miserable at that moment. And it's going to be that way for a period of time until the brain can recover. Mm. And so it's a 1-2 punch that makes it really challenging. I had a patient who had been a long-term alcoholic and addicted to opioids as well, and had done very well until he experienced methamphetamine and brought him to some very dark places. And he told me that this was much more challenging than any of those other substances that he used to use. It is really a devastating addiction.
Mm, Well, thank you, Michael, for your calling into the program. Joining us now, Sam Marr, who lives in Caribou and has been in recovery from substance use for more than 2 years. He's active in the recovery community as well and speaks at events throughout Eastern Maine. Thanks for calling in, Sam. Sam, are you there? Oh, shoot. Hopefully we'll have Sam calling back soon. In the meantime, we'll go to Sean calling from Auburn. Hi, Sean. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer, and thank you for having this topic. So I am not only from Auburn, I now am in Gorham and part of Courage House. And if you haven't heard of it, we are a new sober facility specifically for folks involved. We're getting out of jail and prison and treatment. So this topic is scary for me. The issues of opioids and MAT and now Suboxone, they're the highlight of what we're doing at Courage House. So fearing other substances, it's kind of ominous. And your descriptions, doctor, make it even scarier. So I guess my question is, how do we stay out in front, you know? And how do we, one of the things that's happening is that we're getting people that have very little recovery, but are already getting treated with MAT. And, my question, I guess, is to Leslie and the doctor, you know, how do we promote recovery and stay out in front of new substances? Thank you.
That's an excellent question. It's something that I struggle with patients as well, because we have excellent treatment options for opioid use disorder, but people will continue to seek out other substances even if they're on medication-assisted treatment. And I've seen a huge surge in the amount of methamphetamine use and cocaine use in my patients who are on buprenorphine or methadone, for example. And it's really challenging. You know, the recovery and the psychosocial approaches are much more effective for stimulant addiction like methamphetamine, and they aren't always helpful compared to the medication for opioid use disorder. So in some ways, people in treatment with MAT don't always receive as robust psychosocial treatments and recovery-focused treatments. Because the medication is just so effective that you don't really need it as much. And so we get into this weird situation where we have people who are on medication that is working really well for one addiction, but they have this other addiction that is also incredibly dangerous. And it's really a tough catch-22 situation, because the MAT does prevent the overdose death for opioids, but it does nothing for the methamphetamine use disorder. And that addiction itself is quite dangerous and has an overdose risk too. So you're left with, what do we do in a situation where someone is actively using methamphetamine, we have them on MAT, and we're not really doing anything to address the methamphetamine, and it's just as deadly? It's an open question, really.
I think it's a great question, too, and I think it speaks to the importance of those of us in recovery sharing our stories and the recovery movement really being activists, because the power of stories is, I think, a greater power than just about anything. And there has been so much stigma around addiction, and it has been so in the shadows. And then we see these drugs compared to when I was young. These drugs are now so much more potent, so much more dangerous. The places people go, so dark. And, you know, to see young people with literally no teeth by the time they're 25 because of methamphetamine use, it's really tragic. And I think we have to be activists. I don't think we can be passive any longer. And by being out there and sharing the stories, not only, most importantly, the stories of hope, but sharing that, you know, there is, as the caller earlier said, there is always someone who has been to the depths of where you have been. And if you think you're alone, you're not. There's someone who has been there and has gotten out and can help you get out too. So I think, you know, the time is for activism, for recovery, and I think we're seeing it. We're seeing people come out and talk about it in a way that has never happened before.
I don't want to be a complete downer and say, like, people can't recover from methamphetamine. And I get the sense that I'm kind of saying that to some extent, but that is not what I'm saying, actually, that people can recover, but it really requires much more intensive psychosocial treatment. And I think that's what can be challenging, because just because I would recommend a more intense psychosocial treatment like going to IOP or residential treatment, people in the active state of addiction have different levels of change or ambivalence about what they're willing to do to make a change. And it's a lot easier to just take a pill than to kind of give up your freedom and go somewhere and really do the tough work that it takes to recover. And that's kind of the challenge that I see, that it's really hard to find a simple solution to these problems.
Sean, thank you so much for calling in. If you'd like to call in, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back, and hopefully we'll be able to talk with Sam Marr when we return.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Lamy Wellahan Shoes, committed to reducing greenhouse gases at all their locations throughout Maine, because what's good for the environment is also good for business. And AARP Maine, working to lower prescription drug costs. Learn more at aarp.org/rx.
The death penalty is a controversial political issue, especially during presidential elections.
Bush supports the death penalty for first-degree murderers. Dukakis not only opposes the death penalty, he allowed first-degree murderers to have weekend passes from prison.
I'm Ari Shapiro. With the federal government resuming executions, we look at the issue of capital punishment in past campaigns. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's coming up this afternoon at 4 o'clock right here on Maine Public Radio. And coming up in just a few minutes at 2 o'clock, we'll have ideas from the CBC. We'll learn about the Portuguese model for dealing with widespread drug addiction. 2 decades ago, Portugal was in the grip of a nationwide drug epidemic. The dire situation led the country's leaders to a radical, daring solution, the decriminalization of all drugs and a healthcare approach rather than a criminal law approach. This approach is now celebrated around the world as the Portuguese model. That's Ideas from the CBC coming up in just a few minutes at 2 o'clock right here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today, we're talking about methamphetamine use in Maine. Joining me, Roy McKinney with Maine DEA, Leslie Clark with Portland Recovery Community Center, and Jonathan Fellers, an addiction psychiatrist. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Hoping Sam Marr is with us now. Sam, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, good. Thanks so much for calling back and making this work. Share your story of how you became addicted to meth and where you are today.
You know, it's a long story, but I'll keep it short. You know, I'm just like a lot of other people. I grew up in a small area, and I always felt like I didn't have enough of everything, so I thought I had to have something more. And I thought I found it in a substance that could remove me from myself, you know. I didn't come from a bad environment. I didn't come from an addictive environment, but I always felt like I needed something a little bit more than what I had. And I thought I'd found that in substances from a young age, you know, in high school. It started slow with alcohol and other drugs, including like my first drug was cocaine. It moved into pills and other opiates. And later on in my youth, I thought I had to find something that could keep me going because I enjoyed partying too much, and I could never stay awake long enough or have the ambition or the energy. And I thought I had found the perfect substance, which was methamphetamine, and it made me feel the way I was looking for. And at some point I realized that what I was looking for, like, there was never enough. There was never enough, you know, and it became such an easy substance to be able to get my hands on that it just became from a point where I could use it socially to a point where I needed to use it in order to feel normal, I guess. So,
Sam, let me ask you this. You heard what the law enforcement agent said on the program today, that Maine is getting targeted. Are you surprised by that? And do you sort of, you and people you know, feel that you're being targeted?
As a person in recovery?
Or as a person, who used to be a user and is now in recovery, yes.
No, not so much. I remember while I was using, I remember feeling as though like the rates of use had become so much higher. I remember being young and in high school that certain substances you can never get your hands on. And then as a person now in recovery, I look back and I see a lot of the people that I used to hang out with while using, people that, the rate of like law enforcement, like enforcing around methamphetamine has definitely gotten higher, but it's also true that the amount of methamphetamine coming into our state, the rate of it has gotten way higher. It's become a commodity in the community.
Yeah. So before we let you go, what kind of advice do you have for those who are planning to go through the journey you've been through?
It's not as easy as some people make it out to be. I'm a person with over 2.5 years in recovery, and I had to put away people, places, and things. Like, there was no hanging on to that old life. Like, I had to remove myself from every circle, every person, every place. And I just had to, tough through the withdrawals and whatnot, because it is a tough withdrawal. I felt absolutely depressed for almost a year, really, until things started to feel normal. Like, I had to find happiness in other places. Like, I couldn't continue to use alcohol or other drugs. I had to remove it all at once or it wasn't going to work. Like, reach out. There's like the caller said earlier, there's people out there who've been through it, and I have a great recovery community around me. I've got great support. So I've got a great family, and I just have to remain vigilant in the fact that this is a lifelong process.
Well, thank you so much for calling in and sharing your story. That's Sam Marr. He's a resident of Caribou, and he's very active in the recovery community around Eastern Maine. We're going to go to Nathan calling from down East Maine. Hi, Nathan. Go ahead.
Yeah. I've been in recovery for going on 5-6 years now. And I just wanted to point out that John Delaney, the way he talks, he's a member of the prison industrial complex. And their primary work is locking addicts up and exacerbating the problem for addicts. So everything he says needs to be taken with a serious grain of salt.
So, Nathan, are you saying that the DEA should not be going after people who are trafficking in drugs?
Not at all. But they aren't just going after cartels. They're going after people in your neighborhood who have a addiction problem. And they're trying to lock those people up for being addicts, not for necessarily trafficking drugs, for being in possession of drugs. He's talking about somewhere that can produce 7 tons every 3 days of crystal meth. That doesn't mean that place was producing 7 tons every 3 days. And the idea that Maine is being targeted by cartels is something to scare people in the state of Maine.
Okay, gotcha.
So they can get more financial, backing from people.
So I don't have John Delina with me on the line anymore, but Roy, would you like to address what Roy McKinney, would you like to address what Nathan's saying? Are enforcement agents telling a certain narrative so they can get more funding?
Absolutely not.
Oh, hold on. I'll have you repeat that. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. Absolutely not. Law enforcement is focused on the traffickers, the distributors of these drugs. There is insufficient time to look at possessors. Typically, possessors are a collateral. The police are engaged with a citizen. They're answering to a complaint, and they discover that the person is in possession. DEA, Maine Drug Enforcement Agency, and other law enforcement agencies, they're focusing their efforts on those that are bringing the drugs into the state and distributing them throughout the state. When the special agent Delano was speaking to targeting, He's talking about the drug criminal organizations, and they do run it like a Fortune 500 business. They are interested in making money. They look where in the country, internationally, that they can push their product into the marketplace and get a foothold so that they can extract as much money they can from people in order to continue their drug trafficking groups.
We'll move on. Thank you, Nathan, for your call. We'll go to Emily in Booth Bay. Hi, Emily. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you for taking my call. I am a person in long-term recovery from methamphetamines. I actually moved to Maine from Arizona to get away from that certain substance. And I'm just wondering, can people overdose from methamphetamines in the same way sort of that they can from heroin? Is there something to do about it? And how do we, like another caller said, stay in front of this new drug crisis coming? It honestly scares me to hear this, this fact that it's that meth is coming more to Maine. I was pretty glad that it wasn't here when I moved here 10 years ago.
Jonathan, yes, people can overdose,
yes,
correct?
Yes, it's different than an opiate overdose. So opiate overdose, opiates suppress respiration and people stop breathing. And in that way, their higher mortality of the overdose with opiates. But methamphetamine, people have other consequences that can lead to death. For example, it's a stimulant. It raises your blood rate, your heart rate. People can have strokes as a result of that, so a bleed on the brain when the blood pressure gets too high. People can have heart attacks. People can have seizures. And then not to mention the psychiatric complications. So when someone gets very aggressive or paranoid and concerned about things, they can do behaviors that are really quite dangerous. I had a patient who pulled over on 95 because he was convinced that there was someone in the back seat of his car with him, even though he was alone in the vehicle. And, you know, people do some pretty tragic things when they're under the influence of these substances. So there is a high risk with these substances. It's not the same. It's not someone stops breathing, turns blue, and dies like that. It's usually some other reason that they turn deadly. And it's harder to capture that as a specific directly related to the substance necessarily. It's quite clear when someone stops breathing after taking opioids that it's opioid related. After overdose of methamphetamine and you have a bleed to the brain, that doesn't always say methamphetamine overdose death.
Mm. How about Emily's second question? We've already talked about it a little bit. How do we get in front of it, Leslie?
Well, I think that's a really great question and a really difficult question, how to get ahead of it. And I think it speaks to the great work that's going on with law enforcement, medical, recovery community, prevention programs in the schools. Part of that, as I said, telling stories to people that are real and personal. And that all of that together, it has to all come together. And I think it really has, over the last few years, a big difference and change in seeing how these systems are working together. You know, I want to come back to, though, also, I just think the message of the hope of recovery is so important. And I heard yesterday a quote that I guess Eric Clapton, who's been in recovery for a long time. Someone from the band U2 came to him asking what he needed to do to recover. And Eric Clapton said, you're going to have to change everything and you will never regret it. And I think that that's such a true statement. And the important part of that statement is never regretting it, because recovery, before you're in recovery, when you're in addiction, we think that giving it up would mean just learning to live a life of misery. But it's really about freedom. And it's about being able to live a big, bold, joyful, happy life, free of being dependent and obsessed with substances. And otherwise, who would ever get into recovery and do all the work? Because it is a lot of work. But there are 23 million people in recovery in the United States who have found a wonderful way of living and have found freedom from addiction and substance use disorder. And I think getting ahead of it means we just have to keep putting that out there so people know they don't have to live this way.
Thank you, Emily, for your call.
Yeah, those are powerful. Those are powerful words, because it is the drug itself that imprisons the person. And that is what imprisons them, not as one of the callers spoke to about the prison industry. It's the drug itself and how that how a person gets into recovery and the liberation, the freedom from the drug ultimately is that. And to expound on it also, this program is part of raising the awareness that this drug is out there. It is becoming more available, and therefore we need to better educate ourselves both with prevention, law enforcement, and treatment.
At the beginning of the program, Roy, Jonathan said one of the problems is that it's less expensive. How cheap is it?
Well, we see roughly it equates with cocaine on a price, maybe $100 a gram. But it also has the nickname of the poor man's cocaine, because that euphoria, that high, can be extended so much longer than the euphoria associated with cocaine. So it ends up being cheaper for that user.
All right. Well, I'm going to try to squeeze in one more question. Katrina, if you could be quick, that would be great. Go ahead.
Okay. Amphetamines are being routinely prescribed by physicians who fail to tell the victims that these amphetamines could cost them their life, and that's not informed consent, and it will cost the taxpayer trillions.
Sure, Katrina, I got you. So she's talking about amphetamines that are related to methamphetamines and are often prescribed for things like ADHD. Jonathan, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I think it is important to do informed consent, because even taking as prescribed, amphetamines do have side effects. There is a risk for cardiac problems as a result of them. There's a risk for addiction. They are a Schedule II substance. We know that. And there is a risk of psychosis. I have seen patients who were prescribed normal doses of amphetamines and developed delusions and paranoia as a result of that medication. Mm-hmm. I've also seen people develop delusional parasitosis, believing they had insects under their skin as a result of normal prescribed levels.
Well, Katrina, thank you for your last call, and that's going to be the last word. Thank you to our guests here today. The voice you just heard, Dr. Jonathan Fellers, an addiction psychiatrist with private practice, also medical director at Crossroads and at Discovery House. Also here, Leslie Clark, executive director of the Portland Recovery Community Center, and Roy McKinney, directors of Maine's Drug Enforcement Agency. Today's show was part of Maine Calling's continuing coverage of topics related to substance use in Maine. I'm Jennifer Brooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.